Dr. Kavoukian, I did want to mention that your expertise has been recognized in many ways.
Thank you.
You were ranked among the top 25 women of influence, recognizing your contribution to the Canadian and global economy as
a
whole.
Thank you.
You were also named one of the top 100 city innovators worldwide by UBM Future Cities for your passionate advocacy of privacy by design. In addition, Dr. Kavoukian, you were also chosen as one of the Power 50 by Canadian Business Magazine for your tireless efforts as a privacy champion.
Thank you.
With your background, what would you say is the best advice that you can provide to those interested in learning more about data security, compliance, and privacy?
There is so much information out there, and it's hard to be selective. I obviously, people need to read everything they can, but you also need to focus, because if you don't, then you'll just lose yourself in the quagmire of information. So I think one of the most important things is decide where do your interests lie. Are you interested in technology, in a particular kind of technology, or are you interested more in terms of the human rights associated, fundamental human rights associated with the protection of privacy and data protection? I encourage people to delve into both sets of literature, but you need some kind of understanding of where everything started. What I would urge people to do, there's something called Fair Information Practices. This was developed 1980, long time ago, but it was recently revised in, I think, 2014 or 2015. There are a set of privacy principles that form the basis of all privacy laws and regulatory structures around the world. So I would urge people, take a look at Fair Information Practices. What do they mean? How are they reflected in laws? How do you tie these to technology? And then look at a technology you're interested in, biometrics, whatever you're interested in. It doesn't matter. Internet of Things is growing exponentially, RFIDs, big data, obviously. And then see how you could perhaps think of fair information practices in terms of applying to particular areas of technology that interest you. You have to have a passion for whatever you're doing. And you may not know what that passion is. When you're really young, you know, there's a lot to be excited about. But if you can just start by getting an early understanding, one of the first books I wrote is called Who Knows? And I wrote that with John Tapscott. I often point people to that because it talks about the basis of privacy laws and data protection in terms of fair information practices and gives you some context, perhaps, to evaluate new technologies with. But there's lots of literature out there. There's so much. So take a look and critically assess technologies. And is one of the first things I tell companies and governments, whatever you're involved with, in are you collecting personally identifiable data? See, with privacy, if there's no personal information involved, do whatever you want with the data. It won't have any privacy implications. Privacy kicks in when the data are personally identifiable, meaning your name or your social insurance number or driver's license or some identifier linked to you is linked to the data. That's when it all starts, and that's what attracts your attention to the protections you have to afford. So one of the best methods of dealing with this is strongly de-identifying the data. And I say strongly because there are weak de-identification protocols that are, you know, virtually useless because they lead to re-identification. If you use strong de-identification protocols combined with a risk of re-identification framework, then you're golden, because you can dramatically reduce the risk of re-identification to something as small as the risk of being hit by lightning, you know, less than 0.01% or something. So that's what I encourage people to take a broad look at. And if you're collecting personal information, personally identifiable data, and if you're a company, for example, I always tell them, do you have a data map? And by that I mean, do you know how the information flows once you receive information from your customers that's personally identifiable, that is needed for the completion of the primary purpose, whatever the transaction is? What happens to it after that? Does it end? Or does it flow to other departments and other secondary uses? If so, then you've got a built-in consent mechanisms along the way. So if you think of it as a data map and how it flows throughout your organization, it will tell you exactly when you need to obtain additional consent and go back to the customer. All of this can be mapped out in advance.
Dr. Kavukian, you are also responsible for the leadership of the Privacy and Big Data Institute here at Ryerson University. Would you be able to discuss the work that you do here to our listeners today as well?
One of my biggest goals was to dispel people of the myth that big data is out there and there's nothing you can do about it. You know, get over it. When I first started here, I think I was still commissioner. I was just coming over here. There was a big data book written by Victor Meyer Schomburger, and it was an excellent book. I read it over Christmas that year. A little bit light on privacy, but pretty good book. And then in January, he did a video presentation in Brussels that I was watching. And at that point, he said, look, it's just not possible to do data protection in terms of fair information practices with big data. It's already out there. You can't put the genie back in the bottle. Just try to be accountable. Who will hold companies accountable for the uses of the data as opposed to the collection of the data. And I just went nuts. So there's something called IAPP, the International Association of Privacy Professionals, and they publish a daily, it's called the Daily Dashboard, and people can send notes to it and criticisms and things, and they'll publish it if they think it's worthy. So I sent a message to them, and I just said, I cannot believe what I just heard at your conference in Brussels. I completely disagree, blah, blah, blah. And then, so they posted that. And then the next day, Victor Meyer Schomburger comes back and he says, I didn't say that. Da, 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 da. And then I went back the next day and I said, I'm so glad you didn't think you said that. I'm so glad you think we... So we had this back and forth. But what that led to was a paper that I did with my dear colleague, Dr. Alexander Dix, who was the Berlin Data Protection Commissioner. When I heard the video presentation of Victor Meyer Schomburger that I found offensive, I sent it to Alexander, to Dr. Dix. And I said, Alexander, I'm not going to tell you what I find, what my problem with this is. You look at it, and if you have a problem, then let's do a paper together. I love working with Europeans to get a bigger picture. So he called me right back after 20 minutes, and he said, Anne, I believe I know what your problem is, and I agree with you. Let's write the paper together. So we wrote a paper, I think called privacy paternalism. Don't be paternalistic about privacy, you know, saying sort of they're there. There's nothing you can do about this. Of course there is. We could change everything about big data tomorrow if people chose to strongly de-identify the data after their initial use of the data. Not only would that help in terms of privacy for individuals, it would also help companies and government departments because a lot of the data breaches happen within the department. They're called inside jobs. Either inadvertently, poor information management practices, or intentionally, a rogue employee, whatever. The majority of happen inside the department. So imagine, once you finish your use of the data, you de-identify the data, then you reduce your risk of being held for a data breach or a privacy infraction. Look at, what was it, last year, in the United States, the Office of Personnel Management, millions of files involved in a data breach. I mean, this is a huge department, and they can't secure their data. So these are the things that people have to consider. And that's my hope, that we can get a handle on this and get past the thinking of, well, it's too late to do that. It's never too late. You can do this right now.
I strongly agree with you. And Dr. Kavukian, as a leading expert in privacy, you have demonstrated that privacy can and must be included side by side with other functionalities such as security and business interests. Your mantra of banish zero sum enables multiple interests to be served simultaneously, not just one to the exclusion of the other. Would you like to share any final words with our listeners today?
I always want to give people hope. And the good news that I can give you is that ever since the revelations of Edward Snowden a few years ago, my job has become much easier So I do a lot of public speaking. Now when I go into businesses, when they invite me to speak to their organizations, I no longer have to make the case of why they should care about privacy. They're asking me, how do I do it? So the tide has turned. That's the good thing. Much greater awareness since Mr. Snowden's revelations. And people, businesses are understanding that if they embed privacy by design from the outset, that this can, in fact, enhance their business practices. This can give them a competitive advantage because they're raising the bar of privacy protection. And the public, since Edward Snowden's revelations, is much more distrustful of both business and government. They're asking many more questions. And so all of a sudden, you have a distrustful public who is asking for questions. You have a more responsive businesses and hopefully governments who want to raise the bar of protection. And you do also have the General Data Protection Regulation coming in Europe. And the last thing I'll say, and I'm just so delighted, you have Apple's Tim Cook, who is taking such a principled position on the need to protect personal information on iPhones and other communications devices. As he has pointed out, this is not, do not believe it's about one phone. The FBI already have another 9 phones lined up. The New York District Attorney has 175 phones lined up. Please, this is not about one phone.
Yeah.
But it's critical, as Tim Cook is saying, that we protect the information accessible through iPhones and mobile devices. As you very well know, it's not just phone conversations. I have an iPhone. I do all my banking on the iPhone, my medical information. I have a lot of surgeries and things. I get all that information through my iPhone, all my personal communications. I mean, you name it, it's on my iPhone. My life is on there. So the government wants to be able to access that? No, there has to be. I need to be assured that that information is strongly encrypted and protected. And not only for me, but for businesses here in the United States and Canada who offer those services. I want to applaud them. I want them to be the ones to succeed. If the FBI wins this case, and I don't think they will, but if they do, you can kiss privacy goodbye. And I'm certainly not prepared to do that, nor is Mr. Cook. And that's why I'm sure this case will go all the way to the Supreme Court, because whoever wins the first round, the other party is going to challenge it at the next level, and it'll continue to escalate until it goes to the Supreme Court. These are very, very important matters. The other thing is, only about a third of the encryption products produced are produced in the United States. Bruce Schneier, leading cryptographer, did a survey a few months ago, and he reported that two-thirds of encryption products are produced elsewhere outside of the United States. So what would happen if there was a ruling in the United States saying Apple and other companies have to reveal everything, develop this back door? And it is developing a backdoor, because right now that technology does not exist for them to open up this iPhone. They'd have to craft new technology. What would happen if they were told they have to do that at all times? Business would go outside of the United States to all these other countries offering strongly secured products. It's an untenable proposition. And also, countries outside of the United States, China, Russia, etc., they would also go to Apple. Open up these devices. There would be no privacy, no security associated with all of our sensitive information and our transactions. That is not a world I want to live in. So let's hope that Apple gets the support it needs to fight this all the way.
Dr. Kavoukian, I immensely want to thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to meet with me today. At the same time, I greatly appreciate you talking to our viewers and to our listeners about the impact of the work that you've done. Privacy by Design has made a significant impact in the world of privacy. And as mentioned before, I will include a link in the publication.
Oh,
so I encourage everyone to look at the main principles that make up the Privacy by Design.
Thank you so much.
And at the same time, it's been a pleasure.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Oh, and let me mention one more thing I forgot. We're now offering Privacy by Design certification. Companies are now so excited, and as I said, see privacy as a competitive advantage, that they want to be certified to show their customers that they're doing this right. So we've partnered with Deloitte, and we're offering Privacy by Design certification for products and services offered by companies. So take a look at our website, And you'll see a description there. And thank you for your time and for giving this very important message to the public. I applaud you for doing that.
Thank you very much.
My pleasure.